pale. Under Section 16, the tribal sovereignty section of the IRAs, one disadvantage is that it requires practically an act of Congress to convey land out of the tribe, or even to mortgage it, to make some working capital. However, most IRAs have... Yes, Section 177 says you can't deal... Section 177, the Non-Intercourse Act of Title 25, says you can't deal with an Indian tribe with respect to its land without being punished. There's $1,000. It's not a misdemeanor, but there's a penalty to it, and it's a void transaction. But most of these IRAs have two forms of entities. One is the traditional tribal organization under Section 16, but there's also Section 17. And that's why the Secretary of the Interior issues a charter of incorporation. It's a corporate form of IRA. And when one reads the charter from the Secretary, usually there's a provision in the charter authorizing the corporation, Section 17 organization, to transfer real estate. So with some care managing the kind of organization that is utilized within the IRA, you can overcome that disadvantage. Likewise, David Case reminded me yesterday that there is an Internal Revenue Service ruling out that the Section 17 IRAs are likewise exempt from federal income taxes. Those who want to export have an opportunity there also. When the IRAs were organized in the late 1930s, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was devoted to the village concept. As of then, and perhaps today, many of the villages do not have the willingness to fight with the BIA. As I indicated yesterday, the native mind does not like confrontation. So that through the decades, and to some extent today, the BIA, by force of personality, pushes the IRAs around. Particularly if the IRA has borrowed government funds. The BIA always called their loans every year. All of the income, then, for example, in the canneries in Southeast, all of the income from the sale of their canned salmon went back into the federal treasury. It went back into what we call a revolving fund. It was not gone, it could be reloaned. So that the village IRAs, who theoretically were the managers of the canneries, had to get down on their hands and knees in order to get working capital for the next summer's operation. You did not have a continuing line of credit where the government would have a hard time calling a loan.
Material there to use in their high school programs. that they have tapes, not necessarily written material, that they can use as curriculum. There's curriculum development happening on a more formal level, but I think this kind of grassroots curriculum development, and I don't think Tuksuk Bay on Nelson Island is alone in these kind of attempts, are really important. The desire of the elders that sat on the council to make available, to put into the formal education, they now have a beautiful REA high school, but it doesn't often teach what they want to be taught, and this is one attempt to make the sorts of things that they want available to their to the younger generation. And then there would be teachers like Martha Dementia that who can teach in a culturally appropriate manner. She's not alone, thank goodness, and there's a growing number of Native individuals that are becoming formally certified as teachers and are able to participate in the schools, and that's been happening now over the years, and it's a real positive thrust in education of Natives in the state. And what people like Martha, what Martha will teach, does teach, are values, cultural values, like sharing, which implies the obligation to give, necessity to share, not just something you do if you feel like it. Values including group responsibility to the group, not just responsibility for yourself. The value of respect is there in, I'm sure, how she treats her students as well as the content of what she teaches. These are fundamental, I feel, fundamental Native values that differ in some instances from non-Native values, and I know it better from what I think of my own values, what I was taught. The things that I've learned at Tuksuk, they often, on Nelson Island, they often strike me because they're very different from the way that I was taught as a kid. My folks' main thrust when they were raising me was for me to be independent and off on my own. When my husband and I decided to come to Alaska, they were happy that that happened. Sure, they were going to miss us, but the whole burden of raising me was so that I could be all off on my own. They were glad to see that I'd finally accomplished what they'd set out to do. I was an independent individual. My parents as elders, and now they're living with my grandmother, who's 90 years old. I've never referred to them as elders before. They're getting up there. I think they qualify. They expect to be left on their own. Listening for non-Natives and Natives alike in Anchorage, that kind of thing seems to me to be very, very positive. And one of the good short-term as well as long-term outcomes of meetings like this. So there is this issue of education, which I've given sort of some of my views. I would like to hear more on this issue from the panel here. But before I hand back the mic, I also think this issue brings up the issue of unity. There's an ambiguity, I think, in what's been talked about over the last couple days. As I stated in the paper, I thought that the testimony reflected the fact that for Alaska Natives during the land claims settlement, the battle to pass the land claims bill, unity was not a goal per se, but a means to an end. Now, diversity was certainly recognized, but I hear people here saying that unity or identity as Alaska Natives, and I guess John Borbidge, when he talked about his own family, he had to talk about Alaska Natives because within his family there are now Tlingit, there's Indian, Eskimo, and Aleut. He couldn't, and I gather Fred Paul's family tree would have, he'd have some of the same problems there, or advantages, whatever. So that your identity as Alaska Natives, as a group, is really important to people, and it's valuable to people here personally, as well as to you as a group. So unity is important as a tactic, but it's also important to recognize what all Alaska Natives have in common, that's an important personal recognition. And I think in that lies a real strength, that concept of unity that seems to have changed. There may be a difference today from what was going on in the 80s, in the late 60s. I'm not sure, but if people could speak to that, I would really like to to know more as to how that strikes you.
Just before we go on, I should respond to what Martha Dementiev said. When this commission was in Monick and Tununuk last week, it was made clear to them that the commission was appointed by the ICC and that the job was to obtain the views of Village Alaska and Alaska Natives living in urban centers and to write a report based on what they said to enable Native people to plan their own future.
But it's sure nice to know that you have retained some of it and fought hard enough to prevent them from taking it away from you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wright. I was going to call on Francis Degnan next, and then Mr. Hope, if that particular story about Venetai is one to which you wanted to add anything, and then Mr. Ewan and Mr. Tiolana. But before we go on, I think it should be understood that in this commission we can't conduct an inquest into disputes that occurred in the past within corporations, and these disputes may be illustrative. They may illustrate that the Act has pitted Native people against one another, or that it is in some way dissipating revenue in fruitless contests. Perhaps that is so, but I really don't think that once the courts have decided a matter one way or the other, that this commission can go into it. And I think, Mr. Wright, that I should say that I don't think the kind of label you applied to Mr. Julius Brecht is appropriate terminology to use here. I know there are strong feelings about these matters, but I hope in future we can proceed without recriminations. Anyway,
I feel that, you know, when any of the panel members here bring out personal experiences, it's important to give insight as to how the Claims Act came about and how we're working with it, because what best, you know, those are, the way I feel, would be taken in that vein, because I think each one of us can best relay what's happened to us as individuals, and I don't believe any one of us here are out to, you know, put anyone down. And sometimes we, as Natives, we're always honest and forthright, and so when we decide we're going to call a person a rat, we do it right to his face, you know. But what I would like to say is that in our real situation where we're today, looking back at the land claim settlement, out in the villages, the people very definitely feel the land belongs to them.
Yes, I'd like to further add to what she had to say. It seems very strange that the entire destiny of Alaska has been decided without the consent of the Native peoples in any recognizable democratic way. It didn't happen in the Statehood Act in 59, and it didn't happen in 71 at the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act. I think that what we have here, the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act, if we wish to, as the people, I can hear the panel members expressing the interest for the children and the continuation of the culture, and they mention self-determination, and we mention sovereignty. What we have in these corporate structures is placing our land in feudal tenure. We do not have that in America. We have
the people of the United States gives the power to the government, not the government giving the power to the people. And what the Alaskan Natives have and had and still have is alloidial land title. What that means is we own the land, the government doesn't give us the land, the government doesn't give us our rights. We have always had these rights. And if we sit here and continue to discuss the pros and the cons of the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act, the pros and the cons of the IRA, all of those are placing our sovereignty, our self-determination rights under a trustee-trustor relationship. What we have in the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act is not any type of a settlement for the natives, so to speak, but a settlement, without being redundant, to British Petroleum or ARCO or Sohio or Anaconda Copper or any of these other foreign state enterprises that wish to make a profit on the resources of the state of Alaska. What we have is the people of Alaska. The Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act justifies third-party trespass actions. Our resources, our life blood, our future that is ours, rightfully ours, is offsetting the national debt of other nations of the world. The east-west debt structure is now a north-south debt structure. We're being placed under another legal system. And if we allow the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act to continue and just sit here and discuss all of the goods and the bads about it, what will happen is through acquiescence, our native common law will then change. We will then be subject. It will be our law. And we are giving away what is rightfully ours. And I think that it seems to be somewhat of it's a detriment to the people, to us, to continually try and make something work that wasn't designed to work for the benefit of the native peoples from the start. So I would hope that people, it seems we're now being more and more educated. We understand now, 12, 13 years later from when the act was passed, We are now discussing the things that we wish to see happen aren't happening, and they won't happen because they were not designed to happen. And the people that supposedly went to Washington, D.C. and represented me, I didn't vote for them. My mother didn't vote for them. My grandmother didn't vote for anyone to go and represent and come out with a bilateral agreement, which is what we don't have. We have a unilateral agreement. And the people that did supposedly represent us, I don't believe that they really understood all of the legal ramifications of what we are now living under. And I would hope that we, the people here, would take a different look, maybe a look at these meetings and what we have under a different light, and understand that we won't have sovereignty and we won't have self-determination under what we have now. It is not possible. Thank you.
Entities functioning, because this is primarily their business. We have the situation in Southeast, not born of a desire to be at all deceitful or to maneuver, but it just happened. On our board, we had people concerned about subsistence, and we had commercial fishermen. And there frankly are some areas where you simply cannot reconcile the viewpoints of both. So I feel that subsistence must more and more be taken over. And I understand in some areas of the state has been taken over by the tribal entities. Finally, I would urge, and I strongly recommend, that when state legislation is proposed, which proposed legislation will affect the ANCSA corporations in any manner, shape, or form, the shareholders should be timely informed. In no wise should ANCSA corporations push through laws that affect the corporations or the people without the people knowing ahead of time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Broadbridge. I think that I will just take a couple of minutes, first of all, to thank all of you who came to this first three-day session and to invite you to come to more.
Beginning. To go on to the subject of this particular conference, Judge Berger asked, is that Berger or Berger?
Berger.
Berger, thank you. Judge Berger asked us to consider ANCSA and any flaws that we could see. I'm not a board member of any corporation. I do volunteer my time and services for various organizations. But I'm speaking as an Alaska Native who is concerned for my children and for myself and for my family, and as an extension of that, my community, my region, the people who belong to the state of Alaska, and then the people all over the world that we'll be hearing from later on within this conference, indigenous people, people who live with the land. The impact of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, I feel, is something that we can never erase. It is written now into our history, and there is no way that we can ignore ANCSA ever. One of the impacts that we have had as a result of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act has been on the education of Native children. With the advent of ANCSA, the emphasis shifted from subsistence survival to economic and political survival. ANCSA made it a requirement that we place an added emphasis on a working knowledge of the English language, so that we could wage effective war in the courts against established masters of the uses of the English language. This emphasis on a knowledge of English was accompanied by a perhaps unintentional de-emphasis on the value of the native tongue. At ANCSA's advent, parents were faced with the blank page of the future, and they were forced to make choices as to what they should impress upon their children as priority life tools. And many of these parents, including my own, seeing the wave of progress, so-called progress, that was sweeping our land in the 50s and the 60s, chose education in the Western way, in the Western tongue. Others chose to press on with the subsistence way of life, considering the working knowledge of Inupiaq ways of survival and the Inupiaq tongue, Tlingit, Athabaskan, Tsimshian, Aleut, and they pressed on with that. Now our young people are suffering, and the old are suffering, from a lack of ability to communicate with each other. when I was growing up and acquiring a certain proficiency in the English language, and as I became older and as the realization began dawning on me, at first I thought I should be learning Inupiaq because I considered it was important to me to learn in order for me to speak effectively to my elders. Now I realize the importance, yes, is on communication, but in the other direction, because my elders have so much to teach me and they're unable to communicate with me because they're more proficient in Inupiaq and I'm more proficient in English. When this happened, this division of the people, just in language, this aspect, there came a kind of a myth that arose out of it in the people that we met who were non-native, because they met those of us who could articulate, and they thought, now there's a smart native. And they encountered natives who could not articulate because they'd chosen the other way, and they thought because they couldn't articulate in English that they had nothing to say. Articulation doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. There are people at home who chose not to, who stay, who don't attend the meetings, who don't read the newspapers. They live the Inupiaq way of life, but that doesn't mean that they have nothing to say. They live what they have to say. So many times in gatherings such as this, there's the temptation for those of us who can use English to put on the public face and to speak only to the white people that are present. I want to speak today to the natives that are present. The white people that are present can be interested bystanders if they want to. I am speaking to the natives. When we complain about a lack of franchise on part of the people who carried through ANCSA, who brought it into being, we're not putting down the people that did it. We're not accusing them of bad intentions. I'm sure that they were serving the highest of their intentions, and no, I would not call them tools of anybody. But they did have the lack of franchise to a certain extent. I see that in remarks by my own father, who after ANCSA was enacted said, you know, I never signed a deed. I never had a check addressed to me saying, Stan, we've bought your land, here's your money. That's what we mean by the lack of franchise. That's what I mean by the lack of franchise. And I don't mean to be accusatory. I would caution that whatever steps are taken to ameliorate what's been going on, that the next time you start acting and amending, that you obtain a franchise, obtain as far as possible the input from our people. ANCSA, ANCSA brought and emphasized and strengthened the Western concept of land ownership. Whereas in the Inupiaq and other native cultures, that concept was alien to us. Remember the chief in Washington State or Oregon State who asked a very valid, a very great, a very true question. about a treaty that was established down there. And he said, how is it possible to own a river or grass under your feet? How is it possible by extension to own the animals and the resources? It's possible only if your whole idea of yourself is based not on the land, but on cash, on a cash economy. And that's what happened with the advent of ANCSA. It's possible in the cash economy to buy fish and sell fish, to buy the resources and sell the resources. That's something that I find hard to forgive about ANCSA, that it strengthened that whole ingress of the Western way of life into our way of life. Another thing that ANCSA did was that in order to compete in this new world, a world that was peopled by corporate entities who were masters of the game again, I use that word again, the old game of money, that we were babies at it, and we got taken quickly, savagely, by these masters. And our own people, in the best of interests, many of them, striving to compete in this world, had to acquire a savvy to enable them to reach the board of directors, to reach the administration positions within the corporations. And in so doing, had to abandon the very thing, the very nativeness of them that made them want to help in the first place. They weren't the same people once they reached those corporate heights, and it showed. It showed pitifully, because we were taken not just by outsiders, we were taken by our own people. Corporate figures do not answer the need for which ANCSA was supposedly enacted. The need to protect and maintain and uphold our identity as natives, to help us keep our foothold on the land. David Case had asked the question, how can natives own land and stock as individuals and promote cultural values as whole communities? And I agree with Lily. It struck me as soon as he said it. I wrote his question down to make sure I'd gotten it right. It's backwards. Within the native tradition, the material things are shared, but the cultural spirit is imbued into our children by us as individual parents, aunts, uncles, grandparents, brothers, sisters. Not to be totally negative,